Radio New Zealand News at 8 o'clock. I'm Paul Brennan. A supporter of Alan Hubbard and his wife Jean says he's in a state of shock after the couple was seriously injured in a car crash today. A small car being driven by Jean Hubbard collided head-on with a four-wheel drive vehicle about 5 kilometres north of Oamaru at about 1 o'clock this afternoon. Alan Hubbard, who is 83, has been flown to Dunedin Hospital in a serious state, while his wife, who is 82, has been driven there by ambulance with fracture injuries. The 40-year-old driver of the four-wheel drive vehicle has been treated and discharged. A supporter of the Hubbards, Paul Carruthers, says he understands their family is on the way to the hospital.
The timing is awful. Going to a hearing next week to talk about overseeing the statutory management. I know that Alan's been under phenomenal stress. Right now, it's just a state of shock, really.
Paul Carruthers. Alan Hubbard is due to appear in court next month facing 54 charges after a serious fraud investigation into failed companies he ran. The government could face further earthquake costs following a declaratory court judgment which found the Earthquake Commission is liable to cover multiple disaster claims on one property. The High Court of Wellington considered whether EQC would cover multiple claims on a property damaged by more than one earthquake. All residential buildings and contents which have fire insurance are covered by EQC for up to $100,000 for the building and $20,000 for its contents. The court found that as long as a residential property had fire insurance, claims for damage up to the $100,000 level could be made for each natural disaster which caused damage. Earlier this week, the commission more than doubled its initial estimates of how much it will have to pay out for the Christchurch earthquakes to $7 billion. The New York Times says the U.S. government intends to file a multi-billion dollar lawsuit in the next few days against more than a dozen major banks. They're accused of misrepresenting the quality of mortgage securities they sold at the height of the housing bubble. The BBC's Marcus George reports from Washington.
According to a report in the New York Times, the Federal Housing Finance Agency is taking legal action against a dozen banks. They include Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase. The agency has to accuse them of failing to perform sufficient checks on the quality of home loans they made and then sold on. The report says it's demanding compensation for losses made by the government-backed mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who bought packages of the loans. The two companies lost more than $30 billion as a result and had to be bailed out by the federal government.
Marcus George reporting. The Minister for Earthquake Recovery, Jerry Brownlee, says tolerance for delays in demolishing badly damaged commercial buildings in central Christchurch is wearing thin. Mr. Brownlee says it's dangerous for everybody if a large, badly damaged building is left standing. Rachel Graham reports.
The Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Authority's demolitions manager, Warwick Isaacs, today said that a tender for the demolition of the 17-storey Clarendon Towers would go out next week, even though they had not been able to reach agreement with the owners. Mr. Isaacs said there were legal issues which were holding out reaching an agreement. Mr. Burnley says the authority's demolition team had shown a huge amount of patience and diplomacy in dealing with owners. But he says tolerance for what he calls mucking around is at an end, and he hopes building owners understand that. In Christchurch, Rachel Graham.
Fathers are nearly three times more likely to run over and kill their child than mothers, according to a review by the Child and Youth Mortality Review Committee. The committee released a report examining deaths from low-speed runovers, which typically happen in the driveway of a home. Jessica Horn reports.
The report found that on average, 5 children die in such incidents each year, and that for every death, 12 children are hospitalised. It also shows that nearly 36% of incidents have a father at the wheel, while just over 12% involve mothers. 20% of the drivers are family, friends or visitors. Suggested ways to reduce the number of incidents include checking for the whereabouts of children before driving off and keeping children separate from driveways. Mr. Baker says most deaths involve children under the age of 6. That's Jessica Horn.
And that's the news.
Music from the Pacific.
Hey, 校のシンボルといたしまして、旅客船ミートスをお送りいたします。これを機により一層両国間の友好が深まりますようお祈り申し上げます。ありがとうございました。
Thank you. I can't stop, okay. What's the game? What's the living on my face? On the beat, bigger, fast track. Watch out for what's coming back. To victory, yes, can I see? Bigger, bigger, faster than ever. Who's got you on the fever? Yes, I believe ya. Pump it up, get the bubble from the spin. There's a bit of new trend. From NZ to UK and back around again. Back around again. Make them all on the right. Stay low as the fastest day up. Push strong island is on the map. Strap at the top. This is how we ride. Don't stop, say you wanna. In case you don't know my name, just to lay low. Strong on the crew, yo, yo.
Listeners to the BBC services to the Pacific in Auckland for a half hour of current affairs from Radio New Zealand International.
Radio New Zealand International, Pacific Regional News, I'm Anil Husband. The chair of the Pacific Islands Forum may miss next week's Pacific Islands Forum Leader Summit in Auckland. Vanuatu's Satu Kilman has been battling to have Parliament sit and pass a supplementary budget. It has been stymied on several occasions by the Speaker, Maxine Carlo-Cormann, who is a member of the opposition. Don Wiseman has more.
This week, Mr. Kilman missed Fiji's Enhancing the Pacific meeting, Commodore Frank Bainimarama's alternative to a forum summit. He also missed the earlier meeting of the Melanesian Spearhead Group leadership at a small island state's get-together. This is because he's embroiled in a battle with Mr. Carlo-Cormann over what motions Parliament can debate. He wants Mr. Carlo-Cormann gone, but the veteran speaker has so far deflected these efforts, saying he's following standing orders and the MPs haven't been. Parliament is now due to sit next Thursday to debate a motion calling for the removal of Mr. Carlo-Cormann and also consider a supplementary budget for the salaries of more than 100 unpaid teachers, the school fees for children in cyclone-affected Tapia, and to pay expenses for students at foreign universities. But this parliamentary session will clash with the forum, and it's possible Satu Kilman will choose to stay in Port Vila to try and stabilise his government. This is Don Wiseman.
The Fiji interim government's alternative to the Pacific Islands Forum Summit has issued a communique saying the nations which attended see Fiji's strategic framework for change as a credible homegrown process in preparing the country for elections in 2014. The leaders of Papua New Guinea, Tuvalu and Solomon Islands attended, along with representatives from Nauru, Vanuatu, Tonga, Kiribati, the Federated States of Micronesia, French Polynesia and the Marshall Islands. They say Fiji, which has been suspended from the forum, needs to be supported in efforts to publicise its economic and political progress. The leaders back French Polynesia's push to be re-inscribed on the United Nations decolonisation list. They've backed the establishment of a regional police academy and say a technical working group should be set up to look into donor aid funding. They thanked the PNG government for offering employment opportunities to small island states as the country's economy continues to soar. A New Zealand-based campaigner for democracy in Fiji says the people of his country are poised to stand up to the interim government. The interim president of the Fiji Democracy and Freedom Movement in Wellington made the comment during this afternoon's protest against the regime outside the New Zealand capital's Fiji High Commission. The Council of Trade Unions-sponsored protest follows the internet distribution of photographs of anti-interim government graffiti, vandalism of police buildings, and a texting campaign by an organisation calling itself VT Revolutionary Force. Sai Lea Lea says people in Fiji are showing they've had enough.
The VT Revolutionary Forces, you know, the kind of fascists have never happened since the coup. They're anti-regime graffiti, you know, labelling Bainimarama and Kayun as liars and evil and murderers. That's never happened, you know, and now the burning of state assets. So that's an aspect, that proves to you that people are getting better, and in other ways they can be expressing themselves.
Lea Lea says the key thing is that protesters preserve some semblance of law and order. There's a call for the Australian government not to use next week's Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Summit to undermine the sovereignty of the island countries. The call from NGOs in the Pacific and Australia comes as the forum leaders are due to reach a decision on the mandate for the Vanuatu-based Office of the Chief Trade Advisor, or OCTA. That body was set up to give independent trade policy advice to the island nations on the planned regional free trade agreement known as PACER Plus. The Pacific Network on Globalization says the decision on the office's mandate is a matter of sovereignty for the island countries, but it says Australia appears to be standing in the way. The Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network says Australia promotes good governance in the region, but then limits the ability of island governments to decide what's in their interest. It says the Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, needs to show Australia respects the sovereignty of the island governments by ensuring the decision on the OCTA remains in the hands of the island governments. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it will not be involved if Australia restarts its policy of processing asylum seekers abroad. Hundreds of asylum seekers originally bound for Malaysia are being held on Christmas Island as the government in Canberra awaits urgent legal advice on how to proceed after the High Court scuttled the asylum deal with Malaysia. The Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, says she's considering all options, including reintroducing elements of the previous government's policy of processing asylum applicants in Papua New Guinea, or Nauru. But the UNHCR's regional representative, Richard Tull, says his organisation will not be involved in such a move. He went on to say, whatever policy approach is taken next by the government, it should be tested by the High Court. While Papua New Guinea's former Prime Minister, Sir Michael Somare, is due to return to Parliament next week, his family continues to hope he'll retire. Sir Michael has been receiving medical care in Singapore since April, but is expected in Port Moresby this weekend in time for a critical early recall of Parliament on Tuesday. This week, Sir Michael declared he remained the country's Prime Minister despite his controversial ousting in his absence a month ago, and that he intended completing his term. In late June, one of Sir Michael's sons, the MP Arthur Somare, said the family wished to retire Sir Michael due to the uncertainty surrounding his medical state. It sparked an outcry, not least from other members of the Somare family, and now Arthur Somare says he was incorrectly quoted. He says retirement is a decision only Parliament can make.
If you read my statement and watch the media interview, I made it absolutely clear that I had no power to retire it. It was really a public expression on the family's behalf to take a life in retirement.
The PNG MP, Arthur Somare. A business in the Northern Marianas is to pay $80,000 and provide other relief to settle a pregnancy discrimination lawsuit. The US Equal Employment Opportunity Commission had brought the suit against AA Enterprises, which had refused to pay the pregnancy-related medical expenses of at least four women, despite it paying the medical costs of other workers. The pregnant staffers were threatened with dismissal if they didn't agree to cover their own medical expenses, and at least two were ultimately dismissed for reporting the discrimination. The money will cover back pay and other compensation. American Samoa's chief immigration officer, Ufuti Edemir, says there are over 1,400 overstayers in the territory, and he's passed this information on to the LV Bay Medical Center. Ufuti made the revelation when he appeared before lawmakers to testify on a bill that plans to fine the sponsors of overstayers. The fines mooted are $10 for individual sponsors and $100 for business sponsors. Ufuti Edemir says it'd be one way to locate the overstayers and bring down the numbers. The Marshall Islands Retirement Agency is again having to withdraw money from its international investments to meet retiree benefit payments. The Marshall Islands Social Security Administration says unless there's a law change, the fund will be exhausted in about 9 years. Our correspondent, Giff Johnson, says this is the third year the agency has run out of local revenue.
The amount each year is escalating. In 2012, they're estimating they'll have to pull out nearly $4 million in investments to cover the retiree benefits. And the problem this situation causes is because the retirement fund in the Marshall Islands is not very well funded to begin with, in just a few years, it could exhaust all money and then there won't be any retiree benefits at all.
Johnson says the government appointed a task force last year, but it is yet to issue a report on its findings. A mayor in French Polynesia has been convicted for abuse of power after he refused to marry a couple because the woman had had a sex change. The Court of Appeal has fined Thomas Moltame, who is the mayor of Tapu Tapu Atea on Raiatea, $5,000. Moltame has also been ordered to pay $1,800 to the couple. In 2007, he refused to officiate, despite the couple presenting a document of a tribunal which showed that it recognized that the bride no longer was a man. Moltame claimed religious and moral objections to the sex change and unsuccessfully appealed his conviction. Moltame has said he's prepared to go to the highest court in France prove that there's no law to sanction his refusal. And that's a bulletin of Pacific Regional News from Radio New Zealand International.
Hello, Andy. This is Dateline Pacific. A look at current affairs in the region from Radio New Zealand International. I'm Don Wiseman. Today, Sir Michael Somare is about to return to Papua New Guinea after nearly 5 months of medical care in Singapore. Fiji moves to regulate nursing. The call for Pacific Forum leaders not to ignore the simmering conflict in Papua. The Solomon Islands government makes a huge payment to end a long-running industrial dispute. And Polynesia's Nuclear Test Veterans Organization backing a campaign for an international conference to help those affected by nuclear fallout. And we look back at the first week of the Pacific Games in New Caledonia. Papua New Guinea's Sir Michael Somare is set to return to Port Moresby this weekend after nearly 5 months of medical care in Singapore. This week, Sir Michael issued a statement declaring he remained the Prime Minister and intended completing his term. In late June, one of Sir Michael's sons, MP Arthur Somare, released a statement saying the family was retiring Sir Michael due to the uncertainty surrounding his medical state. The statement said it wasn't an easy decision to take without full and proper consultation with Sir Michael. Sparked an outcry, not least from other members of the Somare family. Now Arthur Somare says he was incorrectly quoted. A month ago, Sir Michael was controversially replaced by Peter O'Neill after a parliamentary vote declared his Prime Minister's seat vacant. Arthur Somare says his father's attendance at a special parliamentary session on Tuesday is critical to a Supreme Court reference that he and other East CPAC MPs have sought following the change in leadership. He says Sir Michael's attendance will help clarify questions about the former Prime Minister's absence that have been raised by the Attorney General, Alan Murrett.
The issues are related to absenteeism as opposed to a vacancy. And they're questions that I don't necessarily want to ponder over because they are questions that are before the Supreme Court at this particular time, and the Supreme Court have been given a series of questions to answer with regards to those issues of absenteeism, vacancy, and so forth.
Well, so as far as Sir Michael is concerned, there is no vacancy, and he effectively wants his job back as Prime Minister.
Well, reading from his article, yes, that there is, that there was never a vacancy. Quite simply, the functions and the responsibility of the Prime Minister falls to the Deputy Prime Minister, and he has full functions of a Prime Minister during the period that Sir Michael was away. Sir Michael was given leave of absence from a number of Parliament sessions, and Parliament had sanctioned it, and as such, he maintained that there was no vacancy.
I guess the essential problem is that your National Alliance fractured over this, didn't it? So it's not as if it was the opposition that's taken over, it was a coup within the government.
Yeah, I think the issue there was not the vacancy itself. The core issue of
National Alliance faction was in relation to succession. Who would be the next leader of the National Alliance Party when Sir Michael eventually exits? And that was the core issue. This issue of whether there was a vacancy or not is secondary. The core issue was, did Sir Michael put a succession strategy in place? Who was to be the successor after Sir Michael?
So Sir Michael is flying down from Singapore in the weekend.
Yes, he's departing Singapore on Saturday. He should be in Port Moresby on Sunday. And everything being good, hopefully he will be in Parliament on Tuesday. And it is absolutely necessary that he be in Parliament on Tuesday, because the core question that we have before, obviously, the Supreme Court at the moment is the issue of vacancy itself. The laws of Papua New Guinea are quite clear. If Sir Michael misses three sittings of Parliament,
then there is a vacancy.
Then there will be a vacancy. So he needs to make that journey down and attend.
That's PNG MP Arthur Samari. Fiji interim government passed a new nursing decree regulating nurses, midwives and independent nurse practitioners will all now need an annual license to work. Fiji's health minister says a new Fiji nursing council will replace old governing boards, and every nurse will need to meet ongoing education requirements to stay registered to work. Jenny Meyer has more.
Dr. Neil Sharma says his people no longer want to be treated like guinea pigs, and foreign nurses will need to gain registration from a new council if they want to practice in Fiji. He says that under the decree, nurses on temporary projects such as teaching or research will need to be registered with the council to protect the public interest.
Any nurse coming in here to Fiji will have to apply to the council for registration, whether it's conditional or temporary. They're coming in for short periods. Sometimes you find that in developing countries you have all sorts of people coming in and doing all sorts of things which they wouldn't be able to do in their own country. We no longer want to be treated like guinea pigs.
A clinical nursing facilitator for universities in Queensland, Rosemary Hibbert-Foy, has worked for volunteer service abroad in the Pacific region and has also tutored many Pacific Island nurses in Australia and New Zealand. She says nurses should make sure they work legitimately on overseas health assignments and liaise with non-government organisations. She says she's aware of cases where travelling nurses have been critical of local services and had no chance to change or improve health care because they weren't registered.
I would say that any nurse who's wanting to go through an NGO to any Pacific country, including Fiji, that they go through that organisation that's supporting them and to ask the NGO to go through the correct channels to make sure that it is okay for them to work there.
The General Secretary of the Fiji Nursing Association, Goini Lutua, says her team was only given one day to consult on the decree and says nurses in Fiji are double-minded about the changes. She says those who have worked overseas are familiar with annual registration, but many say they are underpaid, overworked and can't afford a yearly fee to work in a public health system that's supervised by the government anyway. She says it's important for the nurses' union, which is regulated by other decrees, to continue a dialogue with the interim government. She says at the end of the day, it's the public whose health will be affected. So it's very important that the nurses' voices are heard by the health ministry through the association.
So that the concern that they raise has got to be addressed. Because if we lose nurses who are not happy in the new system that's going to come into play, then Fiji will suffer from trying to run a health system that will benefit our people.
Goini Lutua says it's important to continue to speak up, as many nurses are finding life hard at work and at home. She says she's looking forward to analysing the detail of the decree when it's made public. This is Jenny Meyer.
The Pacific Islands Forum's been told it must speak out about the ongoing instability in the Indonesian region of Papua. Groups representing the indigenous Melanesian people of Papua want them to be given observer status at next week's Forum Summit in Auckland. Pacific leaders once spoke out about the violence and human rights abuses perpetrated by the Indonesian military in Papua, but have ignored the issues for the past 4 years. Spokesperson for the Australian West Papua Association, Joe Collins, Because the forum has to realise these abuses have been going on for many years, and it's a matter that won't go away. He told me why recognition from the forums is so important for Papuans.
First of all, they actually believe they are a Pacific people. They say they are not an Asian people, and they are not part of Indonesia. They say they belong to the Pacific. They are the same as PNG. So they do want to be classed as Pacific people, which they are. They also believe that because the situation is so bad, human rights-wise, in West Papua, they feel that they really need international help to help solve the problem. And of course, the Pacific Island Forum is one of the largest regional organisations we have in the Pacific, and they believe that the Pacific Island Forum leaders should really be taking on the issue of West Papua.
Who would it be that would get recognised? There's not one group, is there, that effectively represents an alternative government or a local administration?
No, well, that, of course, would be for the West Papuans themselves to organise, but what would have to be, from my personal opinion, would be those West Papuans who are seeking independence. I mean, you don't talk to West Papuans who are, and there's very few of them that would want to be integrated with Indonesia, but I mean, the fact that on just the beginning of this month, towns of West Papua took to the towns all around West Papua demanding a referendum indicates that nearly 48 years after Indonesia took over administration, they are still calling for a referendum. This has to show the Pacific Island Forum leaders that this is an issue that is not going to go away. It's going to get worse. I mean, just recently, you saw the leaked capacity document, but it's basically a hit list of West Papua leaders, and they are only civil society leaders, which is Jewish people. And they are on a compassist list saying they are separatists. I mean, they are actually not separatists, of course, because they are not trying to separate from Indonesia, but they believe they have never been part of it.
The Pacific Islands Forum used to comment on Papua, and now it has assiduously gone out of its way, it would seem, not to make any reference whatsoever to Papua or against Papua.
I think that finally they may realise that there is an issue that's not gone away. Because the Pacific Island Forum is one of the key regional organisations, they actually have to speak on the issue of West Papua. How can you talk about security in the region if you do not actually take on one of the last conflict areas in the Pacific, and this is actually West Papua? I mean, they are a key regional organisation, and by ignoring West Papua, they are shown that they are basically afraid of the issue of West Papua.
It's the Australian West Papua Association's Joe Collins. I'm listening to Radio New Zealand International's Dateline Pacific. The Solomon Islands government signed an exit agreement with Russell Islands Plantations Limited. It's costed millions of dollars. The settlement, in which the government will take over Rappel's assets on Yandina, will end 8 years of the investment's non-activity and protracted labour disputes. Rappel was a key producer of cocoa and copra products, and a major contributor to the economy. So it became embroiled in court action with the workers and the union. Well, Louis Tully too has more.
The government recently signed a $5 million, or just over $34 million Solomon Island dollar exit agreement with Ripple Investors, ending 8 years of wrangling. The Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce says the government's move to buy back assets from the plantation's estate offers huge investment potential and benefits to the local economy. The Chamber Chair, Tony Kurawa, says it is a back relief, and he is excited at how the estate could be developed in future with the next investor.
I think it's a welcoming news to see that, you know, a major issue that's been outstanding for quite some time can have an impact on the economy has finally been sorted, and we now can have an environment where investors can be, you know, given the confidence they need to be able to go and invest in that place and just contribute more into the economy of this country and, you know, keep driving our private sectors forward.
But our correspondent Richard Toke says not everyone was happy in last week's signing. He says the government's agreement is for over $3 million for Ripple and over $1 million to pay off former employees. He says some landowners now want the land first taken from them under British colonial rule returned.
The original landowners, I would reckon, I've spoken to one of them at last week's signing, and they would love to, you know, have the title of the land by.
A spokesman for the Solomon Islands National Union of Workers, Tony Tagelby, cautions the right investor or group of investors is needed. Ripple's been involved in various labour disputes in the country. It's lasted over 8 years. Tony Kagelbach says it is time for a fresh start.
Forget about the past, let's move forward to reopen my curriculum. I think it is very vital and very important for the economy of Solomon Island. So we believe we move forward, don't sit on this problem and stay there, keep moving.
He says the union wants to meet with the government to discuss what to do about four remaining labour dispute cases related to Ripple, which are still before the courts. The management and government officials have been unavailable for comment. This is Sarah Boyd-Tomasoy.
French Polynesia's nuclear test veterans organisation has joined a campaign to organise an international conference to help those affected by nuclear fallout. Japanese groups and the UN officials in New York this week to highlight the issue raised by people in Algeria, Japan, France and French Polynesia. The head of Mururoa, Tato Roland Oldham, in Tahiti, says this follows last year's push by the UN Secretary General to end all nuclear testing.
Last year, Park Ki-moon was in visiting Kazakhstan. He was visiting also the nuclear site. He made a declaration last year that the United Nations should put together a foundation to help all the victims around the world and also to repair reparation for the nuclear site that are still contaminated. He made that announcement last year. And we also talk about the 29th of August being the International Day Against Nuclear Weapons. We've been having a lot of conference again. We had this idea of organizing international conferences for the victims, having something together for all the victims. That's why the appeal came up. I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki 2 weeks ago for commemoration. I also made the appeal in Japan. The idea for us, our Japanese friends are having a meeting with the United Nations. This is NGOs.
What countries are supporting this initiative?
For the moment, we've been working with Japan, Algeria, and France, of course. And we have translated this appeal in many languages in Russia, because this declaration had been made in Kazakhstan, English, of course, French, and Japanese.
According to the estimates of organizations like yours, how many people have been affected badly by the nuclear weapons tests over these, let's say, last 50 years?
Well, it's still very hard, but to say, I think I have a number at from the last conference since I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But there was less approximative number. But the thing is, the reality is that the more we go, the more there is victims. Like in Japan, we talk a lot about also, of course, traditional victims, you know, of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the generation after. But now this is also the cases of Fukushima that have been a big worry in Japan for the last conference I was at. And the idea is really to force governments to change the policy as far as nuclear power goes.
That's the head of Mururoa, Tato Roland Oldham, speaking to Walters Weifel. Sport now, the Pacific Games has reached the halfway stage in New Caledonia with the home side dominating the medal tally. But away from the competition, organisers have been busy addressing concerns with the athletes' village, while one competitor was banned after being found with performance-enhancing drugs. Benny Wiley reports from New Mayor.
After the glitz of the opening ceremony, it was quickly down to business for New Caledonia. The host tops the medal tally in Apia 4 years ago, and with a week of competition almost complete, their medal haul is already more than twice that of their nearest rivals. In the pool alone, their territory has picked up 23 of 30 gold medals over the first 4 days of competition, with further success coming in karate, tennis and bodybuilding. The first gold medal of the Games was won by Tahiti in the Baja. The world champions claimed a perfect 8 gold medals on the opening 2 days of competition in Noumea. Part of the victorious men's 1500 metre crew, Tehotu Dubwa, says when it comes to Tahiti, paddling is in the blood.
We start very early on. Now I'm in Tahiti, 9, 10 years old, they began up. So maybe it's this and the technique and the training. We have a good coach too, the teachers, huh? The goal to come here and get the 12 gold medals for Tahiti.
Tahiti also won 4 gold medals in bodybuilding, despite one of their competitors being banned after being found in possession of performance-enhancing drugs. Steve Wong Fo was charged by Customs in Noumea with one count of illegal importation and a further police charge of possession of illegal substances. He's received a four-month jail sentence but suspended for 3 years and is banned from competing in bodybuilding for 3 years. Fiji is sitting third in the medal table after sweeping the shooting competition and also excelling in karate, while Tonga's bodybuilders picked up 2 gold medals. Games organisers say they're thrilled with the big crowds tuning out during the opening week, with the swimming finals in Dambaya selling out and the boxing finals in Asvata also proving popular. The president of the Pacific Games Council, Vidya Lakin, says the interest from locals has been a pleasant surprise.
The crowd in almost all the competition venues is beyond their expectations. People who did not seem to be supportive or interested in sport are now flogging to a sporting venue.
One of the ambassadors for the Games, World Cup winning footballer Christian Karambu, says with the territory moving towards greater autonomy, hosting the Pacific Games is a big opportunity for New Caledonians.
I think that this game is very unique because you can see the solidarity around the Games, and this can give us an idea how to build a country, and we need to measure this impact that happened here to show and see how we behave all together. In the end, we are capable of a country and a nation.
Organisers have experienced some teething problems, however. Construction of the Games Village at the University of New Caledonia campus was late to start, and on arrival, some athletes complained that their rooms were dirty and lacking basic items such as rubbish bins or wall plugs. Transport problems and a logjam in the village dining area have also affected the athletes. However, organisers insist these problems have now been resolved. The Games continue this weekend with the popular athletics program starting at the Noongar Valley Stadium. And Vaha is among the sports to head to the North Province as part of the organisers' watch for all New Caledonians to see and be involved in the Pacific Games. This is Vinnie Wiley.
And it is Radio New Zealand International's Dateline Pacific. Thanks for joining us, Alan Wiseman. Until next time, talk.
To the BBC services in the Pacific in Auckland. Rejoining the BBC from London.
Radio New Zealand News at 9 o'clock, I'm Paul Brennan. A supporter of Alan Hubbard and his wife Jean says he's in a state of shock after the couple suffered serious injuries in a car crash today. The small car Jean Hubbard was driving and a four-wheel drive vehicle collided about 5 kilometres north of Oahu at about 1 o'clock this afternoon. Alan Hubbard, who is 83, was flown to Dunedin Hospital in a serious state, while his wife, who is 82, was taken there by ambulance with fracture injuries. A supporter of the Hubbards, Paul Carruthers, says he understands their family is on the way to the hospital. The 40-year-old driver of the other vehicle has been treated and discharged. Alan Hubbard is due to appear in court next month to answer 50 charges of fraud after a serious fraud investigation into failed companies he ran. The head of the Financial Markets Authority, Sean Hughes, says the sentences imposed on former directors of the failed Nathan's Finance Company send strong messages to boardrooms and investors. Kenneth Moses, Donald Young and Mervyn Doolan were found guilty at trial for breaches of the Securities Act. The company went into receivership in 2007, owing $174 million. Today in the High Court in Auckland, Doolan was sentenced to 2 years and 4 months jail, and Moses 2 years and 2 months. Donald Young received 9 months home detention. Mr. Hughes says the sentences are a good indication from the court that this sort of misconduct is serious.
It's a good indication from the court that this sort of conduct or misconduct is serious and will be treated as serious. And we're pleased with the outcome. A lot of work was put into this matter and we think it sends a very strong message both to the boardroom and to investors.
The Financial Markets Authority Chief Executive Sean Hughes. Doolan and Moses are seeking bail pending an appeal. The Overseas Investment Office has allowed foreign investors to increase their shareholding in one of New Zealand's best-known high country stations. Malta Peak Station Trust owns or controls about 26,000 hectares of land in Queenstown beside Lake Wakatipu. Oram Holdings MKI Limited in Monaco has bought a further 7% share of the property owned or controlled by the Malta Peak Station Trust for an undisclosed sum. DMC Limited in Israel has bought another 4.7%. The Overseas Investment Office says the restructuring will preserve the working relationships and philosophy shared by the current owners and will benefit the country by providing more jobs. The United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has called on European and other countries to impose more economic sanctions to try to force the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, to stand down. The issue is to be discussed at a meeting in Poland of European Union foreign ministers. The BBC's Aaron Bennett-Jones reports.
Both sides have entrenched political positions. Opposition activists say the government is murderous and must go. Government loyalists say that if Bashar al-Assad were overthrown, there'd be uncontrollable sectarian violence. The opposition has made some attempt to create a credible alternative leadership, but so far with limited success. For its part, the government has talked of political reform, but with the security apparatus killing those who oppose the existing political order, few believe that President Bashar al-Assad would hold genuinely free and fair elections in which the ruling Ba'ath Party could be removed from power.
Alan Bennett-Jones reporting. A dedicated band of red, white and green supporters has turned out at Wellington Airport to welcome the Welsh Rugby World Cup team. The team was greeted by cheers and a rendition of Wales's national anthem along with a waiter from a Kapa Haka group. William Ray was there.
Several hundred Welsh supporters crowded into the Wellington terminal this afternoon. The Welsh team are ranked sixth in the world and one supporter dressed in a Welsh dragon costume told me he thinks they'll walk away with the cup. Others were less sure but still greeted their teams with loud cheers and handed out daffodils to players as they walked past. Wales is in for a tough start, kicking off their World Cup campaign against South Africa in Wellington on the 11th of September. This is William Ray.
South African team will arrive in Wellington at about midnight. And Italian fans have turned up in force at Nelson Airport to welcome Italy's Rugby World Cup team, which will be based in the city for the tournament. The chair of Swimming New Zealand, Murray Coulter, has resigned in the wake of an independent report that describes the sport's high-performance program as dysfunctional and lacking leadership. Also follows a letter last month from a group of regional delegates calling on the entire Swimming New Zealand board to resign. Mr. Coulter says he'd like to play a part in plan changes to the sport, but his continued role as chairman is acting as an impediment and he's standing down immediately. Swimming New Zealand will hold its AGM in 3 weeks' time. And that's the news. This weekend, MediaWatch seeks out signs of earthquake fatigue in the media and among the public. And as our grand old news agency dies after 132 years, we look at the three brand new small ones now trying to fill the void. We'll also hear how the media put words into Hone Hillmer's mouth and how a teenage TV talent show trialist's tribulations last Tuesday trumped a $4 billion blowout in our national budget. That's all in MediaWatch after 9 during Sunday morning with Chris Laidlaw on Radio New Zealand National. Greatest Met Service weather now through to midnight tomorrow, Saturday. Northland to Taranaki, Bay of Plenty, the central high country, and in the east from Gisborne through to Wairarapa. A few remaining showers clearing overnight, becoming fine. Low isolated showers developing about western coasts tomorrow afternoon, and a few showers tomorrow evening about Mount Taranaki and Taihape. Whanganui to Wellington, it'll be fine apart from cloud developing in Whanganui at Manawatū tomorrow afternoon. Buller and Westland, mostly fine, a few showers developing north of Hokitika overnight. Fiordland, Southland, Clutha and Dunedin, showers and strong southwesterlies, gale in exposed places and hilltops. Easing tomorrow, showers clearing inland in Southland. A fine day tomorrow for Nelson, Marlborough, Canterbury and the rest of Otago. And for the Chathams,
showers becoming frequent and squally tomorrow. Southwesterly gales developing. They'll rise to be a severe gale by tomorrow evening. We'll have a full roundup of the day's main stories in our next news at 10 o'clock.
Nights on Radio New Zealand National.
It's gumboot time.
Welcome to Country Life. I'm Duncan Smith.
And I'm Susan Murray. We have a colourful programme for you this week.
Yes. What does Shakespeare, donkeys and opera have in common? You'll find out when we go out of town today.
Around the country, gentle rains fall in parts of the North Island, much to the delight of farmers, and in the south, conditions have also been kind.
Later on in our feature story, Cosmo meets the winners of the inaugural Gordon Stevenson Trophy at the National Balance Farm Environment Awards.
But before all of that, here at Country Life, we thought we'd got away with not talking about the big rugby event coming up, but there is, in fact, a bit of a wrong link. Sarita Penny and Doug Edmeads, with the support of the Institute of Agriculture and Horticultural Science, have put together four showcase tours based in Waikato. There's a dairy day, horticulture trip, sheep and bath visit, and equine tour.
We've got a few special guests. We're pleased to say that we've got Colin Meads on one of our tours, which is the sheep and beef tour, and we've got former All Black captain Ian Kirkpatrick on the horticulture tour.
And you've missed out Sir Brian Law, who's going to join. We're going to have the two sows on the sheep and beef tour.
So you've got the two sows tied up with your sheep and beef tour, yeah. But you've also got a sow with your equine tour.
Yes, we've also got Sir Patrick Hogan, who will be available when the tour goes to Cambridge Stud, and then he'll also be hosting at the dinner at Cambridge Race Day in the evening, where guests will have a chance to mingle and then enjoy some racing in the members' lounge.
And so basically you're what, they'll be hosted for the whole day with those guys on a bus, trotting around looking at what sort of things?
That's right, so we've got four tours. They start in the morning at 9:30 and they go to around about 11:30, so it's a full day's activity. Stopping in a couple of different places for lunch. We've got Rob Waddell hosting a lunch at Karapiro on the sheep and beef day, for instance. And then on another, we've got the tour stopping in Cambridge with the Waipa District Council hosting a group of people to explore picturesque Cambridge as a town and city. And then they all end with an evening meal, which is included in the ticket price, at four different locations.
Yes, the idea is to not only showcase farming, but also give the visitors an opportunity to feel and sense the Waikato towns and the beautiful landscape, etc., etc. And I must add, this is not just for overseas visitors. We are hoping and expecting a lot of Kiwis to turn up. The whole idea is the camaraderie which goes with sport, with rugby, with farming. That's what we want for people to be buzzing about on the buses. I must add that these tours are official activities around the Rugby World Cup. The Festival Lottery Board has set aside some money for activities right up and down the island.
It fits in what time-wise between the rugby games? Like how does that fit in?
Yeah, we've designed it so we're hoping to catch visitors who are moving north to the semi-finals and finals of the World Cup. Would love to spend a day trekking around the Waikato and enjoying a nice bus ride and lots of company.
And good rugby related people, as you say, you've managed to sort of rope in. Was it hard to get them on board?
No. The two sirs were just wonderful. I didn't know how to contact them, so I did the obvious thing, just rang them up. You won't know me, my name's Doug Edmeads, da 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 da. I know you, I've seen you, da 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 da. Yes, of course we'll help, etc. They've been wonderful.
It's a non-profit event, so the tickets are only $160 each, which is pretty reasonable, I'd say. If you want more information, check out the tour details at experiencewaikato.com or go to Ticketek.
Now, looking at conditions around the country, and starting as usual in Northland, where it's warmed up over the past week. The predicted rain didn't really eventuate, and the district needs some to give grass a kickstart. Dairy farmers are still pretty busy with calving, while those in retail and towns are slow. Soil conditions have lifted, so if there's rain in the next 10 days, spring will be good. There's still about 15% of dairy farms under extreme pressure to get debt under control, but for the rest, their October milk check, which includes the final payout for last season, will be about $100,000, and that should clear many overdrafts. On the citrus front, the Northland-based Satsuma Mandarin Growers Chairman says exports of the fruit this year saved many growers from making huge financial losses. Brad Davies says not only were exports almost double the previous record of 500 tonnes 2 years ago, the average return per kilogram was considerably higher than for fruit sold locally, where prices were depressed. He says managing an oversupply of Satsuma mandarins locally and the possibility of pulling out of poorly producing blocks needs to be considered.
In South Auckland, rainfall in August was significantly lower than the historical average for the month. There were showers this week, briefly heavy on Friday morning. Paddy potato crops are growing well, but they're the exception. Growth of most other crops like onions and brassicas remains slow, and that won't change until the ground warms up. Some growers are using foliar-applied plant stimulants in an effort to improve the situation. Waikato had very welcome rain as the week ended. It's been gentle, so we'll do a lot of good to get pasture growing. And it's similar for both Tanti dairy farmers. They've had a drain run with calving and between 12 and 25 millimetres of rain this week. On the kiwi fruit front, PFAV is still a very serious issue. Growers have spent tens of thousands of dollars on pruning, high cane and fertiliser in the past month or so, and as the season progresses, they could find they get the disease and will have no crop to sell. On a more cheerful front, the bud burst is underway in gold varieties. King Country is having wonderful lambing weather compared with last year, and survival's good. Lots of triplets that wouldn't have made it last year are skipping. A little rain would be good, but farmers are keener to get through lambing before it arrives. The very cold finish to winter a few weeks back has slowed grass growth, especially on the pumice country. However, generally the central North Island's looking pretty good, and farmers are pleased with their production of $100 lambs.
Since the terrible conditions in Taranaki 2 weeks ago, the weather's been kind. Pasture growth is reasonable, but farms haven't made up for what didn't grow through the cold week. The feed's short, and farmers are using a lot of supplements. Calving's been quite condensed, and animal health issues minimal. If the weather's good for another week or two, the feed position will turn around quickly and things will be great. Get a bad week, and it could be disastrous. Sheep farms are just starting lambing, so they'll be wanting warm sunshine. It's been warm in Gisborne, and buyers were keen at the Matafero sale on Friday. Out of 15 lines of good quality lambs, 6 lines sold for between $142 and $150, and it was a long time before prices dropped below $132. One of our commentators says it illustrates the shortage of good stock.
It's Stortford Lodge sale in Hawke's Bay this week. Some good lambs sold for over $165. Like elsewhere, the region's had a good run of weather since the freeze a fortnight ago, and they almost wouldn't mind a little rain to freshen things up. Most farms are in the midst of lambing, and like calving a bit earlier, it's going well. There's a lot of pressure on pasture with hungry mothers, but grass colour's lifting, and that's a sign things are moving. Wairarapa's had a similar time weather-wise. Calving was compact there as well, and lambing is going okay. Silage and palm kernels being fed out, but farmers are hoping to get stock onto pasture diets by the end of the month. Milk production's good, and they hope to maintain current levels until early December.
Manawatu really appreciating some wind and clear weather this week. Farmers have been able to get out onto paddocks. Growth slowed in the cold snap, but it's starting to move now. Again, lambing's going well, but grass is a bit tight on farms. More lambs have survived the season, which will go some way to making up for a slightly lower scanning percentage. Asparagus spears have started to pop up on Horowhenua in the past few days. Harvesting is a couple of weeks away. Ground temperatures have picked up, so that's good for grass growth too, and dairy farms are looking good. Farmers are into the last 20% of their cows to calve, and milk production's good.
In the Motueka Nelson regions, orchard equipment has been calibrated in preparation for spraying, as next week apple and pear trees will start using an oil-based substance to control scale insects, mite eggs and black spot. Apple pruning is coming to an end, and the last of the new trees are going in. The early peony flower crop is doing well, and they're currently sitting at about 150 millimetres. When they're harvested in mid-October, the beautiful blooms will have grown to a height of about 1.2 metres. Marlborough's had a fine week and vet conditions are about 6 degrees above normal. Daffodils are showing and some apricot orchards are in full flower. There's been little rain recently, so soil moisture levels are dropping fast, but at this stage farmers aren't too concerned as lambing and calving is going well and conditions are perfect for preparing pasture for fodder crops. In the provinces, vineyard workers are still pruning and lifting wires in preparation for spring.
The central area of the west coast had a bit of drizzle this week and grass is starting to move. Some farms up the Grey Valley are getting a bit on the dry side, but no one's complaining as it's good for calving. Milk production's creeping up and is a bit ahead on last year. That's because calving started earlier than usual. After a fine spring week, Canterbury farmers on the upper plains woke up on Friday morning to 2 to 3 centimetres of snow. There was no wind with it, so stock were unaffected. Conditions have been perfect for lambing and calving. Growth is getting underway and soil conditions are ideal for cultivation and sowing. The last of the carrots are being lifted. In South Canterbury, soil temperatures are finally starting to rise to between 7.4 and 8.5 degrees. And there's some noticeable growth starting to show in early sown cereals. Lambing's in full swing on coastal farms and is starting in early flocks further inland. Calving's close to finishing. Feed is holding up very well, and with pasture coming away, any shortage will soon be gone.
Despite nighttime temperatures hitting a chilly -5 this week, the sun's been shining and grass is sprouting in central Otago. Stock are in tremendous order. Scanning percentages are up and ewe shearing's going very well, with wool weights up a kilo this year on some sheep. Calving's underway and most farmers still have plenty of winter feed reserves in store. Eastern Southland's been graced with a few skiffs of snow this week, but this hasn't stopped pasture from freshening up. Ground conditions are still quite wet though, with stock on breaks making a bit of a mess. Hoggets are being cleaned up in preparation for shearing. Wool prices for clean ewe fleece has sold in the region this week for $6.53 a kilo, and that's well up on last year's $3.64 for the same type of fleece. Rising one-year-old bulls are doing okay and are currently weighing in at about 270 kilos, whereas the two-year-olds are beefing up with the scales hitting the half-ton mark.
You're listening to Country Life on Radio New Zealand National 101 FM. Today we're off to meet Andrea Thompson. Andrea's the president of the Donkey and Mule Society of New Zealand. She's also a trustee of the Donkey and Mule Protection Trust. We're in a paddock at her place, not far from Fielding and Manawatu.
All the Italian names, have they?
No, they have the names.
Like the opera. And ones that I buy and that I haven't read, they have Shakespearean names, like this is Pabato. This Hermia, she was brought in, so she's got a Shakespearean name. And her progeny have been called Lysander and Titania and Oberon. But my opera ones, like I've got Fafner, he comes from the Wagnerian line, and I've got Brunhilde and Fricka, and there was Freya. And then there's Mimi, and her mother is Musetta, and Violetta, and Angelotti. There's Don Giovanni, who's Tosca's son. And they've all got coats on. They have. They've got covers on because we get a lot of rain here. And donkey's coats are not waterproof. So when it rains, the rain goes right through to their skin, unlike horses. So if they're out in the rain doesn't run off. And they get quite chilled without covers. And we had a really heavy rainstorm. And you came out here, they'd be shivering and shaking. So because we get quite heavy rain. Donkeys are rather, they've got a great sense of humour, and one of these donkeys here, Giovanni, he will grab the cover if he's in a playful mood and sort of shake it and he can get the cover off. This is why this donkey here has got another cover on top of the other one, because that's his particular friend. And twice he's pulled his cover right off over his head, and it's got stuck around his legs, and he's completely wrecked the cover. And the first time I couldn't work out what had happened. The second time it happened, then I suddenly realised it was Giovanni, Don Giovanni, who'd pulled Alfredo's cover off. So he's got this unlined canvas cover holding down his weather beater, so Giovanni can't wreck it. Three here, so they're competing for a bit of a cuddle. Yeah. They're very friendly animals, donkeys. They're very inquisitive, but they're very sociable, and they just love human company. And that's the thing that's very attractive about them. I used to have horses. Gradually got less and less horses and more donkeys.
So what were your stars in this paddock?
Well, some of them are stars for different reasons. The two with the stripy covers, they are my harness donkeys, and I compete at combined drives, it's carriage driving competitions with them. And now I've got other donkeys here that have won champion, because I show as well in the AMP. And there's one of them, the one over there, she's been a World Show champion twice, I've beat her.
She's got very impressive ears, is that
right? Yes. They've got large ears, and people think they have large ears for hearing. It's not for their hearing. Donkeys have very large ears because they're desert animals, and their ears are their cooling systems. So their capillaries are quite close to their surface, like elephants. And that's what calls them off, and quite often that's why they don't like their ears touched, because they are more sensitive than, say, a horse's ears.
How many donkeys do you think there are in New Zealand?
Well, it's hard to say. We do have a register for donkeys and mules with the Donkey Mule Society, and there are about 4,000 in that register, although some of them have died. And not every donkey in New Zealand, of course, is in that register, so I guess roughly there might be perhaps about 3,500, but it would be hard to accurately say.
Tell me about your first donkey.
My first donkey, and I still have him, he's called Hector. He's actually a pure Australian teamster, and I got him to keep my horse company because I was a dyed-in-the-wool horse person when we first came here, and had no intention of having any donkeys, but my horse was lonely, and I'd borrowed him to keep my horse company. And he was a rather magnificent-looking donkey. He was a Jack, which is a stallion, and being a keen showy, I thought, I'll take him to the shows. I took him to the shows, and he started winning, and I thought, well, I might start breeding from her, and it went from there. And now I've got all these, I've got 26 donkeys and no horses. At one time I had all horses and no donkeys. So. I've got three rescue donkeys that belong to the Donkey Mule Protection Trust, and I have donkeys that I have rescued myself over the times.
So you're involved in saving donkeys?
Yeah, well, we rescue and rehome. Sometimes people are no longer able to keep their donkeys, and so we will try and find them a suitable home. Sometimes we have to rescue donkeys. Fortunately, not too often that one has to actually rescue them. More often than not, the ones we have to rescue are jacks or stallions that haven't been gelded, and people, because donkeys have quite a quiet nature most of the time, they are still entires, and a lot of people take that too lightly. And if you get between them and whatever it is that's exciting them, you could easily get injured or killed.
So you might get a ring, somebody will say, don't want this silly thing anymore, it's just had a crack at me.
Oh, well, I have had people on the phone who've suddenly had a jack that they've had as a pet with other animals, and had no problem, and all of a sudden it's attacked and killed maybe sheep or a goat, because donkeys will quite often go for smaller animals, that's just in their nature, and you can't blame the animal for behaving like that. That's why they're programmed naturally to behave, to defend. I had one donkey that was going to be shot because they bought it as a bull donkey, which was running with bulls.
Why do people put donkeys with bulls?
They'll put them with the bulls because they will stop the bulls from fighting, which they do, which is good news for the bulls and the farmers, but it's very bad news for the donkey because the conditions are completely opposite from what a donkey requires. A donkey requires conditions similar to a Shetland pony, sparse feed, they get overweight, they're very prone to laminitis. Donkeys need to have their feet trimmed every 8 weeks and be wormed and so on.
So they can be neglected, really?
They can be neglected. neglected. But even if they aren't neglected, they don't need that much feed. That's the opposite of what they need. Quite often their feet have never been done, and they're long, like Persian slippers. Donkeys should never be on their own. Donkeys are very sociable, like alpacas. They need company. They really need another donkey for company.
Do you know how they do it?
They've got fights between the bulls. Well, the bulls will start fighting, and I think, because I don't know about this scientifically, donkeys are very inquisitive. They're also dominant, and I think the donkeys become the boss animal in the paddock, but also when something's happening, they will go over and see what's happening and get into the middle of it and just break it up that way. They'll stick their head and get into the middle of it, and that either distracts or puts the bulls off.
Mm. They can live quite a long time, can't they?
They do. They live in New Zealand to about 30 years, which is longer than a horse, but if they were in the right conditions and didn't get overweight, they would live to 50 or 60 years. They don't live as long in New Zealand because they get too fat.
So you said that you have to trim their feet every
6 weeks.
6 weeks, that's a big job.
Yes, we do all our own here, of course, with 26.
Yeah, 4 feet each.
Yes. And this sort of country isn't really good donkey country because it's so rich. It's really sort of dairy country, which isn't ideal. The drier it is, or the more we have a drought, the better the donkeys look. And so one of my big problems is that the grass is too lush, so they get straw every day because they just love roughage. They're different from horses. They love roughage, and they'll eat wood, or if you hit like the trees there, they've ringbarked. See, they've killed two of those trees, they've ringbarked them. The driver husband is very annoyed. They eat these
the stations
on the fence, and they look at it like corn cobs. They have beat teeth all down them. She's unusual. That's Renee over there. Her mother died when she was born, and she was bottle fed. And when she was young, she didn't actually think she was a donkey because she used to go in the car with me to. I used to drop her off at a friend's place on the way to work. A daycare, and then pick her up on the way back. And then when she got too big to get in the car, she used to try and get in the car, but she was too big.
You're eating the jeans.
Are you trying them out?
Do they eat all sorts of things they couldn't apart from that?
Oh, they do. Giovanni in particular, he wrecks so much. If I put something down, like a brush or at my jersey or something, I'll come back and he has chewed it all. He just wrecks. He's wrecked so much stuff. I dare leave any of my harness or halters in there. I'll come back and they'll all be chewed up.
I sort of bited my jumper.
Could you leave my thing for
dog? Oh, don't do that. Let it go, Portia.
Push it down,
ending that report. And the music?
That was the overture from Don Giovanni. And Andrea says that even though she has a donkey stud and is capable of breeding champions, she hasn't bred any in the past 3 years. She says there's an overproduction of youngsters and it's difficult to find suitable homes for them. She recommends all jacks should be gelded unless they are intended for breeding. She takes her boys to the Massey University Vet School, where the students learn how to perform the operation. She says gelding a donkey is quite different from gelding a horse because donkeys are bleeders and need their blood vessels to be sutured. She says it used to be that some donkeys would bleed to death during the procedure. There's lots of information on how to care for donkeys on the Donkey and Mule Society website.
Duncan, I think that comes up with too much information, sort of gory.
Yes.
No, I want to know.
Yes.
No, I think it's very interesting, very interesting. Hey, and Roz Rowe from the Leg Up Trust contacted us. If you remember, she was our guest last week and spoke about the work that the Trust does with troubled youth. Well, she said the interview generated a lot of amazing response, and that she was very touched by several Christchurch people in particular, who not only got in touch, but they actually donated to the Trust. And she says, isn't that a great lesson to share with our kids, that in the midst of adversity, generosity shines through to others.
Hi, I'm Joy Bristol of Bristol Plants and Seeds, right beside the lovely Whanganui River. You're listening to Country Life on Radio New Zealand National.
And Bernie Weller manage the family's 890-hectare property up the Waimea Valley in Southland, where they run 2,600 Texel ewes and over 300 Hereford Angus cattle. The Wellers are passionate about sustainability and farming in an environmentally sensitive manner, which has led to several accolades this year, including winning the Southland and National Balanced Farm Environment Awards. Before they won the National Award, Cosmo Kentish Barnes visited the farm that was previously run by Bernie's dad, Pat Ryan. And the top-notch canine accommodation was the first thing to catch Cosmo's eye.
Grant, your dogs are quite spoiled, aren't they, your farm dogs?
Most people think they are, but we put some, about 10 years ago, we started putting heaters in the dog kennels, and it's made a huge difference to their health. We find now that we've got dogs 10, 12 years old that are still working the whole country up in the Tussock and still very healthy and through that winter period. It can get awfully cold down here in Southland and with the frost and minus 5, 6 degrees. They just jump out of those kennels in the morning when it's really frosty and cold. They go there. It's just been fantastic for animal health.
It's like a farm dog motel.
It is. It is. They do very well and they're very happy. Dogs are probably one of the most underrated animals that we have on a farm. They just do so much work, working all day, and then you expect them to be in the kennels at night time when it's cold. So yeah. We really wanted to change that, and it's made a huge difference to their health, and they're just so much healthier all the time.
They look very happy, don't they?
A well-bred dog is quite a commodity at the moment. There's not the amount of breeders there used to be. So to get good genetics and get good dogs, there's quite an expense in that. And so if you can have a dog that's going to last another 4 or 5 years on your farm, it's just so much more efficient.
The dogs here in the kennels have a wonderful view of gorgeous looking rolling hills. Now what are these hills called, Grant?
The Hokanui Hills. They're very unusual hills actually, because most of the mountain ranges in the real world run from north to south. Well, these actually run from east to west. So geologists just love this area. There's lots of big boulders up there. Most of our farm is native tussock country, predominantly filled with silver tussock and red tussock, and a lot of native species up there as well. So they're very interesting hills. Geologists just love it, coming up here and having a look around. So as a consequence, it's running west to east. They're very sheltered from the southerly down here that we get, which is their worst wind. It's bitterly cold, coming straight from the Antarctic, and gives their stock a lot of shelter, and also we grow a lot of grass on our north-facing country.
Yes, and the pasture and the paddocks leading up to the hills is looking very green and healthy.
Yeah, we've had a very good May. Generally May can be a bit cold and you can get a lot of frost, but we've had no frost this year. So we've actually had growth right up until now, which has been really good, and that's why everything is looking very healthy and green. We've had a bit of wind and still been growing right up till now, which can be a wee bit unusual in Southland.
Yes. Are we heading up into the hills?
Yes, we'll head up the lane now and head up towards the Tussa country. And be a bit breezier out there, a bit windier, but we'll get some good views.
Danny, you must have such a strong attachment to this land.
Yes, I do. When we were growing up, we spent a lot of time coming up the hill with Dad. Dad at that stage, because of his age, he had a stock manager, and so Dad was basically doing the maintenance and the development. And so I'd come up and he might spend, you know, the afternoon fencing or fixing up water supplies, and we would just walk around the hills and, you know, along the stock trails and the bush and look for current streams, and it was very much a magical childhood. Mum and Dad were never once taking large holidays off farm. Dad to this day is happiest on the farm, and so we spent many of our holidays just on the farm wandering around. But there was, because of the scope of it and because of the hill, which is something we actually thought every child had,
whole like has. So I, it was a great time. A very free time.
I can see lots of golden tussock lining the side of the hill.
It's rather beautiful, isn't it?
That is a beautiful sight. Something very important for us, that we retain the tussock on our country. It holds the water on that country, it filters it into the creeks and streams, and it also protects a lot of the grasses and also the species of animals that are surviving up here, the insects and the lizards and the skinks. So it's quite important to us that we retain all that on the hill and we farm with it. And it just protects everything, and not only that, but lambing time, and we're in African soccer up here, they can get behind the native, the natural shelter, the tussocks, and they can sit out of the wind, and they're just far more happier, they're just more content, they do so much better. And there's shading also in summer, which is important for the animals. It can get pretty hot in this valley in summer, so we have a lot of metagiri and aprosma and all sorts of natives that they can actually get in under and shade as well. One of the things we're very strong about on our property is a lot of the water is actually sourced on our property, so it's the start of the water system, so we're very focused on our water quality, and that is another one of the reasons why we've maintained not only a tussock cover but our native cover along the creeks. It filters and slows that water down through our property, through our creeks, and if our water quality is good when it leaves our property, it has a chance then to make it to the river in that same sort of quality. So that's very important, and we've said it many times that our water on this property, that is our goal. We do have two main water systems on the property that are gravity fed right down through the front of the property. Some of the blocks or the springs do dry up in summer, so that gives them another water source in those blocks. Bernie's father put that system in 1969, and they made a very good job. Gravity fed, there's no pumps, no pumping, no electricity needed, and it's just a very secure feature of the property, and it gives us a lot of certainty.
Yes. And it runs all the way down the flats, through the troughs, and also into our homes.
Now we're just winding our way up this very steep hill, and there's quite a drop down there, isn't there, Grant? Looking down towards the flat, and we can see all the paddocks in the distance, leading down to the river. Quite a spectacular view, isn't it?
It's a lovely view. It's just a beautiful valley. It's surrounded by mountains on all sides, which protect it and shelter it from a lot of the cold weather that we do get, and also holds a lot of heat in summertime, so we get a great mixture of the cold and the hot in this valley, which means we get a lot of great growing conditions and very healthy country to stock.
Can you tell me a bit about the history of this farm? Now, it's called Cross Hill, is that right?
Cross Hill is the creek that runs across it and then down into the Waimea Stream, which is quite a renowned trout fishing stream. Dad wanted a developed farm, so it was part of a much larger farm station, actually, that ran along the Hokanui's and was broken up for return servicemen. Dad is the only remaining return serviceman, A, still alive, and B, still on the farm. He wouldn't wish to be anywhere else.
And for you, being on the same farm that you were brought up on as a child, it's very special.
Oh, absolutely. It was this farm, it was this love of this land that made me come home. The thought of it being leased out and possibly losing it, I had to drop everything and come home.
Yes.
I wasn't a farmer as such, I just had a love of the farm and of farming, but it was the land. There's no other, nothing else like walking along with your dogs, along the tussock ways, along the stock trails. It's a fabulous feeling, it's in the blood here.
And Grant, you were also brought up in this area.
Yes, I was actually brought up across the valley, on the north side of the valley,
We farmed a more intensive farm over there, but we did go up into the hill country as well. Not in tussock, but mostly developed, but some very steep country. So I was brought up there till we were 20, till I was 21. Unfortunately, my father had health problems along with financial problems as well. Back when I was 21, so we actually sold our home farm, which was pretty tough to see at the time. Three boys, and at that stage we probably thought we'd never end up farming ourselves, or certainly in our own farms. So it's been a real journey to get here, to meet Bernie at that time in my life, and to be able to farm this place, because it's very special. It's very special land. A lot of significance in it with Bernie's family. And we're farming it in a way that's very sustainable, that is going to carry this not only in our generation, but our next generation as well. And that's very important to us.
What's been the toughest time you've had on this farm? The most challenging time?
About 2006-2007, I think. We had goals when we first took over leasing, which was just after we got married, and we had 10-year goals, and we actually completed them in the first five. And then we kind of started to stagnate a little bit, and in 2007 Grant was actually invited to go to a seminar which was held in the Balfour pub run by Ed Welsh of Falkirk.
At that time, it was pretty negative, and a lot of the publications, a lot of the media at that time, everything was very negative. The articles were negative, sheep farming was stuffed, you know, we were going through a pretty poor time with land prices, bull prices, everything was down, beef at the same time was down as well. And it was a time when there was so much negativity coming into our business and our minds, and we really struggled to see the way out of that place. And then a mate of mine rang up and said, look, there's a guy coming down, he's talking all about sheep structure and animal structure, and, you know, and he's a very positive person. So I thought, geez, that sounds good. That sounds just what we want. We'd leveled off. We were sitting in a position where financially we really needed to step up, and we weren't making the profits that we needed to. So I went along and heard, listened to Ian, and right from the start, it just touched the nerve of me, and it was back to basics. It was back to the basic stock sense that we feel has been lost in a lot of sheep farming and beef farming in New Zealand. And it made sense, it was logical, and probably most of all, there was actually no bullshit. You know, he was speaking from the heart, he was very experienced, he had a passion, and we sort of thrived off that. And we engaged Ian immediately on our farm. He went through our stock, he hand-borrowed, and he went through the structure of our stock. And that's when we started down the path of really improving our genetics, going back to basics, running animals in A and B mobs. So we had our A mobs all go to maternal sires, and we breed only from our best stock. Our B mobs in any stock, sheep and cattle, they go to what we call a terminal sire, and they'd just all be killed for the markets. And we've progressed down that path in the last 5 years. It's made a huge difference. We've got quality, consistency in our livestock. We're now in the top 2% for lamb yield in the Alliance Group throughout New Zealand. So we have results. We have it's tangible. And we've come a long way in those last 5 years since we've met Ian.
Gosh, so before you met Ian, you were in a bit of a rut.
We were in a big rut. We knew we had some good stock, but it wasn't the top of our genetics that was letting us down, it was actually the bottom 20%. Mm. So to get rid of that bottom 20% has been huge, because it's lifted our whole system up financially. The efficiency of our A stock are far better. They consume the grass, they don't eat, they don't need as much feed to hold their condition through winter, spring, summer. The lambs do so much better. The structure in the animals that we're killing is what the market wants. So we're very specified, so we've taken that product to market now. And the Alliance Group with the lamb yielding, that has been quite huge, because we know exactly what each lamb is doing, the carcass conformation, and the portion sizes that are coming out of those carcasses. So it's been very important for us moving forward that we actually have a system now that we know exactly what we're producing on farm, we know it's what the market wants, we can take that product to market, and we can get the returns from that.
And Bernie, was it quite scary when dairy farmers did start buying up a lot of this land, this local land, which is quite close to you, quite special to you?
Well, we never actually thought it would happen because of our soils, basically. We don't run any cattle down on our flats during the wet period just because we know the damage they do. So we always thought, no, never happened down our road. But of course it has. We are worried about what will happen in the future with that land. We already know that there has been damage done, and for ourselves who want to be here for the next 100 years, you know, that is concerning. And it is concerning us because many of these farms that it's happening to don't live on farm. You know, quite often they're corporate farmers.
It's more the environmental aspect that are very important to us. We ourselves have moved down a path gradually over the last 10 years into biological farming. For lots of reasons, for soil health, for animal health, for air health. As we've matured, grown older, evolved, it's something we initially didn't. We used a lot of fish products, so 10 years started using fish products. Originally it was fish and seaweed products. It was mainly for a tonic for the ewes and for the cattle at crunch periods of the year before mating, so they go to the ram well, and before lambing. Just more as a tonic, but as we've gradually moved through that system, we've been using less and less synthetic fertilisers. We're now using a lot of guano as our main fertiliser in our young pastures and sweet crops. And we've really had a sense that stock health has improved and our performance has been improving year in, year out. That it's made a huge difference to our soils, our animal health. It's been quite exciting and nothing's fit into that area. And there's a lot to learn in that area as well. More trying to increase the microbiological activity and make the nutrients more available to the plant. There's a lot to learn and it's quite exciting.
Is it quite hard combining environmentally friendly practices with the need to make on-farm profits?
No. And it all goes hand in hand, and it has with us. It has with our farming system. The more we've gone down this path, the more financially profitable we have been. It's that gap between income and expenses, and we are a low-cost operation here. Our expenses are very low, around $33 a stock unit this year. And it's just matched in hand with hand, and the gap is increasing between our expenses and our profit. So to me, that shows that the system is working.
Only a quarter of actually our country, which is more than three quarters of the farm, is actually oversown, and the rest is actually native pasture. And we're getting these results from this. So that speaks volumes about, A, we've got the right genetics, B, the animals thrive in the environment, and see, you know, our management policies are going along the right track.
Yes, and perhaps some more people living in urban and suburban areas need to know that farming is not just about mass producing meat or wool. It's about being custodians of the land and making sure the land is staying healthy for future generations.
Exactly, and it has to be that way if we're going to continue for the next 100, 200 years. We're never going to feed the world. That's something we can't do in New Zealand. But what we can do is produce the best possible product that we possibly can for the future. And I think that's what we need to concentrate on, because that's what we do well. And we're very passionate about it, and we love the land and we look after it, and we're not destroying the land, but we really care for what we're doing here. And I think education is the key, and I think that's going to be a big part of it in the future, educating young people, getting these young kids out from the cities onto property like ours, taking them around the bush, seeing the native fish in the streams, just seeing how it evolves and how we can farm in conjunction with nature. Not against nature, farm with it. We're about halfway up the Hokanais of our property, and it's quite a change in weather from up here down to the flat.
Gosh, yeah, it's rather windy and cold up here, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've just climbed up to the top of the peak, and we can see over now into another valley, which
Must be great for the heat.
Being protected down there in the winter.
This is a beautiful valley. It's got a great aspect. It's not too steep. It gradually rises to the top, 600 metres. It's a lot of it's north-facing. This is where most of their silver tussock in its thickest and its densest is in through this area, and various other natives that are grown down through.
We have two main bush areas which we have protected by the QE2 covenants along with the Landcare Trust, and they are examples of regeneration. They have, it is a mainly broadleaf bush type, which is an example of regeneration, and some of those trees are well over 200 years old. We've got three nationally endangered plants, and David Rance, he's works for the Department of Conservation. He, within an hour, he pointed out more than 100. He said if he'd probably had a little bit more time, he could point out a lot more.
We knew they were special areas, but we didn't know the whole extent of that and what we actually had there, and how important it was, because he told the story, and that's important because now we can tell that story.
Now, we've just found some relief from the wind behind a large Matagari bush, and I'm keen to talk to Grant and Bernie about their amazing achievement at being the 2011 Supreme Winners of the Southland Balance Farm Environment Awards. That is very special, isn't it?
It is, yeah, no, we're just absolutely wrapped. We're just really astounded with everyone who entered, and it was a great competition, and we're really pleased that we went through that this year. It's been great for our business and great for our personal development as well.
What sort of things were the judges looking for?
Really, it was the whole system they were looking at. Everything. Everything you could show them, basically. Everything about the environment, sustainability, financial, just the whole system and how everything worked in together in our farming systems. So it was really the nuts and bolts of our whole operation.
And you've also won two other awards this year?
Yes, we won the Waterforce Water Quality Award, and we also won the Habitat Improvement Award for what we've done with our covenant blocks, and how we also manage the rest of our country, how the stock interface with the rest of the native and tussocks and everything on our property. So that was very rewarding, and it just shows that the good work we've been doing here and the effort we've put in, especially with our water quality as well, that we are looking after it. And it is very important to us, so that was extremely rewarding to us. And as we progress forward into the New Zealand final this year, well, it's going to be the first time they have an actual national winner. That is now our goal, to win that competition. So we're going to put a lot of hard work into it, just like we did with going through the processes we've been through, and we're really looking forward to it. We're looking forward to meeting some of the best farming people in our industry and business professionals, and it's quite exciting, really exciting for us.
So, Bernie, have you had lots of support along the way?
We've got a fabulous team behind us. They're a team of rural professionals that we have that add huge value to our farm and have really helped us progress forward. We're also an organisation called Grow Farm, and this is our online financial system. Along with it, we have Brendan and Karen Walsh, who are our business coaches, and they help motivate us, keep us focused on our goals, and also they have a culture, and so we meet up and we have regional meetings and national meetings, and we meet other like-minded people, and it's all about really knowing your business inside out, and that's been enormous for us in actually going forward financially, knowing where our profit is actually coming from and knowing where our expenses are going. The motivational side has encouraged us to go the full distance when we've got a goal in mind, and this really helped when we were going towards the Balance Awards.
I always used to consider myself as a farmer, that's how I was brought up. I was brought up as a farmer running a business. It wasn't until I changed that mindset around and realised that I was a businessman that was running a farm, that changed that hard mindset, and once I started doing that, that's when it really started pairing forward for me in my mind. You must be a businessman first, if we're not making a profit here, we're not going to survive. Simple as that. But we can do both. We can look, we can make a profit and look after the land. It can work together, and it is here for us.
National Farm Environment Award winners Grant and Bernie Weller talking to Cosmo Kentish Barns in Southland.
That's been our show for this week. Sharpen those old lawnmower blades, or in my case, get out the electric drill so that you can actually start the machine without the pull cord.
Yes, I'm going to get my leaf blower out, I guess.
Have a good weekend.
Bye now.
Thanks, Duncan. Thanks, Susan. Starting the lawnmower with the electric drill. Now, I'm trying to work that out. If I think I understand what you're doing, Susan, you use the drill because you haven't got the cord anymore and the speed of the drill is as fast as the cord would have been to turn the thing around and inside the lawnmower and get it going. Then once it's going, how do you disconnect the drill? It could be tricky. Maybe dangerous. But it is kind of number eight wire know-how, isn't it? You expect that from the Country Life teams. We'll be back again. You can listen to that show again tomorrow morning after 7. And a whole new Country Life is coming your way after 9 next Friday evening on Lights on Radio New Zealand National. 3 to 10. Just wanted to tell you something. If you listened to our interview about Buffalo Soldiers with Eric Hicks before 9, I had to compress that down a bit to fit it into that hour. And you can listen to a longer version on our website, which is radionz.co.nz/nights. Time for a bit of feedback. Now, we spoke to Michael Hurd on Tuesday about his odyssey, sailing to Hawaii from New Zealand, but they got shipwrecked on Rau Island in the Kermit X, and to cut a long story short, they were the mat service. This is back in the 70s, and there was a mat service team there, and they one of them accused Nigel of raiding the medicine cabinet from the Valium. Turned out it wasn't Nigel who'd done it. It was somebody else who was self-medicating. But it was all a great story from Nigel, and Roger was listening to a podcast of our interview in Sydney. He wrote to us saying, a friend of mine sent me a podcast of the Odyssey interview with Nigel about his trainland voyage with Harold. Harold was the captain. I'm very keen to get in touch with Nigel because I helped Harold, Weird Harold, as he was known in Fiji, sail that same trimaran from Fiji to New Zealand a couple of years before Nigel's experience in the early 70s. And like him, I was a young novice and still don't off the anecdotes. Several examples: a plastic sextant, no lifeboat, no night watches, a radio which could receive but not send. For example, warning all boats, foresight gale. Well, they got the warning, but they couldn't tell them they were in trouble. Charts in New Zealand were on tracing paper, which Harold had copied. Now, what else did I say that can't get us into trouble when the sort of libel laws? I particularly like the bit about discovering New Zealand by accident. And then when Harold was asked by the customs officers in New Zealand what his occupation was, he just said, let's say occupation philosopher. The customs officers then immediately decided to go for the boat for drugs. And don't get me started, says Roger, on Hurricane Pam. So I can assure Nigel, it's not he was jinxed when it came to sailing boats, it was Harold. But you both survived. And it sounds like Harold, whatever else he was quite a remarkable character. And one more bit of feedback. Graham Kirkpatrick was talking about the aesthetics of video games on Wednesday. He was discounting the problems with violence in video games, but Marvin in Dunedin reckons that they use military games to train soldiers in the United States, that they sensitize them to violence. Now, you can listen back to those interviews by going to our website. I've mentioned it before, I'll mention it again. radionz.co.nz/nights. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us, nights@radionz.co.nz, or text us on 2101. If you missed it earlier, the answer to this week's conundrum was Joseph Smith, the founder of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. Radio New Zealand News at 10 o'clock.
No mai, haere mai. I'm Paul Brennan with a 15-minute roundup of news from throughout the country and around the world. The headlines: Alan Hubbard and his wife Jean have been seriously injured in a car crash. A court rules that the Earthquake Commission is liable to cover multiple disaster claims on one property, and celebrations as more teams arrive for the Rugby World Cup. A supporter of Alan Hubbard and his wife Jean says he's in a state of shock. after the couple were both seriously injured in a car crash today. The small car, being driven by Jane Hubbard, collided head-on with a four-wheel drive vehicle about 5 kilometres north of Oamaru at about 1 o'clock this afternoon. William Ray reports.
Alan Hubbard, who is 83, has been flown to Dunedin Hospital with multiple unspecified injuries, while his wife, who is 82, was driven there by ambulance with fractures. Mr. Hubbard is due to appear in court next month to answer 50 charges of fraud after a serious fraud investigation into failed companies he ran. A supporter of the Hubbards, Paul Carruthers, says their family are at the hospital.
The timing is awful. There is going to be a hearing next week to talk about overseeing statutory management. I know that Alan's been under phenomenal stress. Right now it's just a standing shot, really.
Dunedin Hospital says the Hubbards family have asked for privacy and it won't be releasing any information on their condition. The 40-year-old driver of the four-wheel drive vehicle has been treated and discharged. This is William Ray.
The government could face further earthquake costs following a declaratory court judgment which found the Earthquake Commission is liable to cover multiple disaster claims on one property. The High Court in Wellington today considered whether EQC would cover multiple claims on a property damaged by more than one earthquake. Kate Gudsall reports.
All residential buildings and contents which have fire insurance are covered by EQC for up to $100,000 for the building and $20,000 for its contents plus GST. The High Court found that as long as a residential property had fire insurance, claims to EQC for damage up to the $100,000 level could be made for each natural disaster which caused damage to the property. About $6 billion has been built up in the Natural Disaster Fund which EQC manages. Earlier this week, the Commission more than doubled its initial estimates of how much it will have to pay out for the Christchurch quakes to $7 billion. However, the shortfall will be met as the Commission has a government guarantee which ensures it will always be able to meet its obligations. This is Kate Gutsall.
The Minister for Earthquake Recovery, Jerry Brownlee, says tolerance for delays in demolishing damaged Christchurch commercial buildings is wearing thin. The Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Authority's demolitions manager, Warwick Isaacs, says a tender for the demolition of the 17-storey Clarendon Towers will go out next week, even though no agreement has been reached with the owners. Mr. Brownlee says the authority's demolition team has shown a huge amount of patience and diplomacy in dealing with owners.
There's a large building standing that's in bad shape. It's dangerous to everybody.
The Minister for Earthquake Recovery, Jerry Brownlee. Two of the directors of the failed company Nathan's Finance have been sent to prison after appearing for sentence in the High Court of Auckland today. Kenneth Moses, Donald Young and Mervyn Doolan were found guilty at trial for breaches of the Securities Act. The company went into receivership in 2007, owing $174 million. Doolan has been sent to jail for 2 years and 4 months. Moses has been sentenced to 2 years and 2 months in jail, and Donald Young has received 9 months home detention. Justice Heath says the sentence should send a clear message to directors of companies who fail completely in their statutory obligations to protect potential investors.
And my conclusions were based primarily on a misleading impression conveyed to potential investors by the prospectus and the investment statement, as later incorporated by reference into the subsequent offer documents.
The lawyers for Doolan and Moses say they will appeal. The United Nations review of the Israeli military raid on a Turkish-led flotilla trying to break the Gaza blockade says the Israelis used excessive force. The report, prepared by a panel headed by the former Prime Minister Sir Geoffrey Palmer, has been leaked in full to the New York Times. 9 Turkish humanitarian workers were killed during the raid. Our correspondent, Nathan King, says the report also acknowledges Israeli forces faced violent resistance from a group of passengers.
Gas range, sometimes in the back, they took us to a frenzied attack. But this is all, of course, in the context of IHH, the group that launched the flotilla, having what the report calls well-armed people on board and ready to do violence. So the picture they are painting is very much one of, as the Israeli soldiers landed on the boats, so they were faced immediately with violence and responded.
Nathan King reporting. The inquest into the deaths of more than 140 victims of the February earthquake has concluded, but some families are choosing to keep their cases open for further investigation. The week-long inquest has heard evidence on people who died in the CTV and PGC buildings, as well in other parts of Christchurch. Coroner Gordon Martinger concluded most cases this week, but he acknowledged some families may have questions that don't get addressed during the upcoming Royal Commission.
The other option would be for me to not conclude the inquiry today, but to adjourn it until the conclusion of the Royal Commission.
Coroner Gordon Martinger. The Labour Party has joined the government in rejecting calls for a parliamentary inquiry into Defence Force actions in Afghanistan and Iraq. A new book by Nikki Hager includes claims the Navy and the Air Force were involved in escorting and protecting the Iraq invasion force, despite explicit instructions from the previous Labour-led government to stay out of the conflict. Here's our political editor, Brent Edwards.
Labour's leader, Phil Goff, says he's seen no evidence defence staff acted against his government's instructions, and he doesn't see the need for an inquiry.
If anybody comes up with documented evidence that shows that the Defence Force was actively undermining the government, of course you'd have an inquiry, but I don't understand that evidence to be there. The distinction is that the government makes the policy and the Defence Force carries it out.
But the Green Party's defence spokesperson, Keith Locke, says the allegations in Nikki Hager's book are serious and need to be investigated.
These are not questions that have to be settled tomorrow. Partly historical and partly current questions, but I think it's worthwhile having an inquiry that looks at the extent of the defence and intelligence relationships in the United States.
While Mr. Gough and the Prime Minister John Key have rejected calls for an inquiry into Mr. Hager's claims, neither has read the book. From Parliament, Brent Edwards.
Flag-waving Italy fans have given that country's Rugby World Cup team a rousing welcome at Nelson Airport this evening. About 400 people cheered as the Italians arrived in what will be their host city for the next 4 weeks. Nelson Mayor Aldo Micio told the team that without Italy's support, Nelson would not be hosting a World Cup team.
It's a little-known fact that 3 to 4 years ago, all support of our bid for Rugby World Cup was instrumental in us hosting matches here in Nelson. And so I gave a round of applause for their support.
Aldo Micio says the Italians could win their two home games in Nelson and beat Ireland to make the World Cup playoffs. And a dedicated band of red, white and green supporters have turned out at Wellington Airport to welcome the Welsh Rugby World Cup team. The team is greeted by cheers and a rendition of Wales' national anthem, along with a waiata from a Kapa Haka group. The South African team will arrive in Wellington at about midnight. The Rugby World Cup building, known as The Cloud, has been officially opened in Auckland, but it will be a week before the public will be able to visit it. The temporary plastic building on Queen's Wharf, named for its rippling white roof, will be part of Party Central during the tournament. It will be used to house New Zealand industry exhibits and host official functions. Rugby officials, business leaders and politicians were at today's opening. An opening ceremony party will be held on the wharf next week. A delay in the Bridgecorp trial means the former chief executive, Rod Petricevic, has more time to apply for taxpayer-funded legal representation. Mr. Petricevic and four other directors were due to stand trial on Monday for allegedly defrauding investors of about $450 million when the company collapsed in 2007. Olivia Wicks has been at the High Court hearing in Auckland.
Another Bridgecorp executive, Rob Bruce, has now received legal aid, but his lawyer says he will need about 8 weeks to prepare for the trial and reassign other cases. A lawyer for another of the accused is in hospital and has also requested an adjournment. Justice Venning has scheduled a meeting for Wednesday to decide whether the trial will proceed next month or late next year, or if Mr. Bruce should be tried separately. Mr. Petricevic, who is the only accused without a lawyer, is appealing against two decisions by the Legal Services Agency not to grant legal aid. In Auckland, Olivia Wicks.
The agency that oversees United States mortgage markets is reported to be preparing to file suit against more than a dozen big banks. The New York Times reports that the banks will be accused of misrepresenting the quality of mortgages they packaged and sold during the housing bubble. The Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is expected to file suit against Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Deutsche Bank, among others. a suit stemmed from subpoenas the finance agency issued to the banks last year. Muammar Gaddafi says he's ready to fight a long guerrilla war in an audio message carried by a loyalist television channel. It's the second message in one day purporting to be from Colonel Gaddafi, whose whereabouts remains unknown. Anti-Gaddafi forces encircling the city of Sirte have given loyalists an extra week to negotiate their surrender. Meanwhile, Western leaders have urged the interim authorities to engage in reconciliation with their enemies. Delegates from 63 countries met to discuss Libya in Paris on the 42nd anniversary of Colonel Gaddafi's emergence as the leader of the coup that overthrew King Idris. The president of the National Transitional Council, Mustafa Abdul Jalil, says the world has staked its reputation in standing up for Libya, and Libyans must now take Libya forward.
Like us, the international community has made a commitment to you. Now we also have to make sure that we fulfill our side of the deal. We need to make sure we have stability and security in Libya. Tolerance and forgiveness must be implemented.
Mustafa Abdel Jalil from Libya's National Transitional Council. The Southern District Health Board has major concerns about the costs of implementing a hard-hitting report from the National Health Board about hospital services in Queenstown. The DHB today voted to accept all 21 recommendations from the NHB, including keeping Lacs District Hospital on its present site, providing a CT scanner and walk-in emergency department care. Steve Wild reports.
The National Health Board Chairman Dr. Peter Foley said in his report that the cost of public health care in Queenstown would remain the same as what the DHB currently funds, which is about $24 million a year. But a board member, Richard Thompson, questioned this and passed a motion requesting detailed costings to be presented in a month's time. Meanwhile, two health action groups in Queenstown who fought for the recommendations as presented by the NHB are happy the DHB has accepted them. In Queenstown, Steve Wild.
Temperatures throughout most of the country were well below average last month, reflecting the front that brought widespread snowfalls. The National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, NIWA, says numerous low temperature records for August were broken around the middle of the month. The average of 8.2 degrees was half a degree below the average August temperature from 1971 to 2000. The lowest temperature record was minus 10 at Lake Rotowiti in the Nelson Lakes, and the highest was 22.1 at both Whanganui and Cheviot on August the 30th. Of the main centres, NIWA says Auckland was warmest, Christchurch coldest, Tauranga sunniest, and Wellington wettest. The Coast Guard says the cost of implementing and policing tougher regulations for 500,000 recreational boaties would be prohibitive. The Rotorua coroner, Dr. Wallace Bain, is calling for all boats to be registered and skippers' licensing to be mandatory following a 9-year-old water skier being run over by a boat on Lake Taupo in 2009. But Coast Guard New Zealand says tougher regulations are not needed, as evidence from overseas shows licensing won't necessarily reduce the accident rate anyway. Its Boating Education General Manager, Mark Bright, says besides the high cost to introduce such a regime, it would be tough to police.
I really don't know how you would practically police it in a country like New Zealand, where we have got such free access to the water. And we're not just talking about the coast and the oceans, of course. We've got lots of rivers and lakes in New Zealand.
Mark Bright of the Coast Guard. Premier Corey Jane has ended the All Black exodus from the Hurricanes, re-signing with the Super Rugby franchise for another year. All Blacks Maa Nonu, Andrew Hall, Penny Wepu and Aaron Cruden are among several players to have left the franchise. Fellow All Blacks winger Jose Aguirre is yet to decide whether he'll stay after missing out on the World Cup squad. Outspoken swimming coach David Wright believes the decision by Swimming New Zealand chairman Murray Coulter to resign won't be enough to stop disaffected regions reversing their call for the entire board of the national body to step down. Coulter has acted in the wake of an independent report released in June, which described the sports high-performance program as dysfunctional and lacking leadership. Also follows a letter last month from 9 regions demanding the board quit and new elections be held. Wright, who runs the blog site Swimwatch, which has been critical of the sports administration, believes Coulter's departure won't be enough to satisfy its opponent.
But he is not the only problem. He may see it as a tactical move to try and save the rest of the board. I don't think that will work. I think that the resolution of the people involved in Auckland and Bay of Plenty and the other regions that signed that is pretty firm.
and they realised that dealing with, for want of a better term, the old guard, a fresh mandate needed.
Swim coach David Wright. And that's the news.